football fan reformed. There, watching the great teams and sharing the experiences with my family and the tremendous fans of this team. A generation of fans growing up rooting for the team did not have that experience, but the next ones will. And I could not be more excited for them.
That was Roger Goodell yesterday. I loved what he said there, and I'll explain why in a few minutes. On the show today, you're going to hear Chris Cooley's film breakdown of Josh Connerly Jr. We'll get to that a little bit later on this hour. Post-NFL draft odds are out and updated, and Washington's over-under on wins for the 2025 season have actually dropped since the draft. I'll get to that a little bit later on in the show. The big show was yesterday to announce the deal that Mayor Bowser struck with Josh Harris and the football team to bring the team back to D.C. It was a spectacle. It was led by the mayor and Josh Harris, and yes, the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell. It was a day that many thought would never come to fruition, and there were many reasons why many people thought it would never happen. A lot of those reasons are now history. Number one, let's face it, the former team name, whether Native Americans felt like it was an insensitive name or not, too many non-Native Americans felt that it was, and that was a hurdle to clear. But that name's been gone now for 5 years. Dan Snyder was a massive reason that no one thought the team would ever be able to strike a deal with the city. You know, part of the irony of the $6 billion sale to Dan Snyder is he actually now has the money to invest in a stadium in D.C., the $2.7 billion that the team's owners and ownership group will invest as part of the deal. Snyder was in a spot in which I don't know that he would have been able to do a deal with the city if he had to come up with the $2.7 billion if he still owned the team. Look, his overall personality and disposition was a problem to begin with. But, you know, a big factor in yesterday's exciting announcement, and everybody was giddy, you know, in a different way, by the way, than the day that Ted with the governor from Virginia announced the move to Potomac Yards. There was a delusional giddiness in the room that day, not even understanding that there would be major hurdles to clear, because that particular day there was an air of this is a done deal. There was also an air of isn't everybody thrilled that we're going to be moving to this beautiful spot just a little bit away from D.C. in Northern Virginia when many were very much dead set against it. Yesterday's giddiness was shared by almost everybody. Not everybody. There are constituents, there are residents of D.C. that don't want this, and there are council members that don't want this. Phil Mendelson, the chair of the D.C. Council, made some media rounds yesterday, and he doesn't seem to be all bought in. Not quite yet. It certainly sounds like he is open to the possibility of a stadium in D.C. So there are still hurdles, but man, yesterday's announcement across the board was received very favorably by fans, by the DMV in general. Returning to D.C. is always better than leaving this city. But there was another reason that this happened yesterday. The other reason is 12-5, two playoff wins, a high-profile NFC championship game at Philadelphia, a season that was the biggest turnaround season the NFL has seen in many years, from 4-13 with literally multiple games getting absolutely blown out by their opponents in 2023, to 12-5 and the NFC championship game a year later with a superstar at quarterback. 12-5 and number 5 had a lot to do with the giddiness over this. It'll have a lot to do with the mayor's ability to pitch this and sell this to the people that she has to convince that this is good for the city. I'm not suggesting that this isn't as a standalone deal, the right thing for the city, that it won't pencil out in a favorable way long term, because I believe that it will. And I'm not, you know, anywhere near astute enough, or certainly I'm nowhere near having the kind of information that the people that cut this deal have to really know for sure. But I think sports stadiums in general are good for big cities, major cities, which we are one of them. To have a big stadium, by the way, aligned with the Capitol and the Washington Monument, those nights, and they are few and far between. Everybody understands that. This stadium isn't going to be used every day of the year. But those high-profile nights where they're playing in prime time on a Sunday night or a Monday night or a Thursday night, and you get those night shots of the stadium aligned like you used to with RFK, with the Capitol and the Monument, it is a source of pride. It is good for the city to look that way, and it's been missed for 27 years, not having a big-time sports stadium in D.C. And by the way, having a dump of a stadium 5 miles away in Landover. You know, we've already seen major concerts, Taylor Swift, etc., pass, World Cup pass. This area's missed major revenue-generating events because it hasn't had a world-class sports stadium. And now it's going to. But the excitement yesterday, the ability for the mayor to get this done, the ability for her to pitch it and sell it to the right people, it certainly helps when in 5 years there's a vision of a winning team and a Hall of Fame on the verge quarterback. Yeah, I said it. Moving in to the new digs. Now, if they had gone 5-12 last year and Jaden Daniels had fallen flat on his face and it was clear that they had made a mistake drafting him, would we still have this announcement? Maybe. Maybe, but it wouldn't be as easy to sell. That's for sure. It's on the mayor now. It's on the mayor to get this done with the city council. I think she can do it. I think she's pretty persuasive. She's an excellent communicator. And there are people that she's going to have to sway. And there will, I am sure, be some horse trading between the team and the mayor and some city council members. I'm glad it's done. By the way, the quote that we came in, Roger Goodell talking about a generation that missed out on what he experienced, what I experienced, what many of you experienced of a certain age. You know, Goodell's father, for those of you who don't know, was in Congress for many years. He was a House of Representatives. He was a senator. So Roger himself, and we've heard this over the years many times, spent a lot of his youth, a lot of his formative years in D.C., and he became a fan of the team. He's spoken about that many times. He's spoken about RFK Stadium and his experience of being in that stadium on its best days many times over the years. You know, the commissioner that he replaced, Paul Tagliabue, was also a massive Redskins fan, having, you know, lived in Bethesda and been a season ticket holder as well. But when he gave that line about a whole generation during the Dan Snyder years missing out on what many of us got to experience at RFK, it was a moment in which, I know I mentioned it right when we came back on the air after the press conference, but I think about that all the time. I think about that lost Skins generation. I have three grown boys, men now in their 20s, and they missed out. You know, all those years of me, you know, taking them to FedEx Field to see games and saying, you know, telling them what it was like when the team was great and what it was like for the city when the team was great, and the connection and the relationships and the gatherings of people from all demographic backgrounds. You know, the city coming to a complete halt on Sundays. And of course, the stories about the teams themselves, you know, the 82 team and the 87 team and the 91 team, but a lot of other teams as well. And even beyond that, so many times sharing stories with them about RFK Stadium and what it was like. I mentioned yesterday somebody sent a tweet to me saying they could still feel it, they could still hear it, they could still smell it. I've said that before too. I can still right now close my eyes and be back in that stadium and smell exactly what it smelled like and feel exactly what it felt like when it shook and rocked. The anticipation for a big game, the electricity in that stadium before a Monday night game against the Cowboys. For those of you that know, I mean, think about, you know, getting out of your car in the parking lot and walking towards that stadium, you know, on a Monday night for a massive Cowboys-Redskins game. And what it was like once you walked into that stadium and you looked through one of those tunnels out onto the field, the electricity was palpable. It was amazing. Now, winning teams have to, you've got to win to create those moments where the game is big enough to get a crowd to behave in that way. There was nothing like it. In my lifetime, there have been two venues that have been unlike any other, RFK Stadium and Kohl Fieldhouse. Those two truly were experiences, you know, on their best days, out of world experiences. Now, it's going to be different. It's going to be different in 5 years. It's going to be a, as they call it, a roofed stadium, not domed. I know that the pictures of what the stadium's going to look like have been going around. I was told by somebody last night, that's not actually a rendition of what the stadium is going to look like. They haven't had those renditions by architects done yet. Now, it may end up looking something like that. I would imagine it's going to, you know, kind of mirror SoFi, you know, translucent, you know, cover, roof, being able to look out, hopefully being able to look out and see, you know, the Capitol, although you're probably going to have to be pretty high up in your seats to see that. But it'll be different because it'll be indoors. There won't be the tailgating situation. You'll be parking in parking lots, or you'll be taking mass transit if you didn't when you went to RFK. 65,000, you know, not 55,000. But I'm sure it will be beautiful. And the key to everything is bringing winning to that stadium. That stadium will sell itself for the first year or two. And by the way, it won't be cheap. PSLs, season tickets, it won't be cheap. I know Josh Harris has talked about making it affordable. We'll see. We're 5 years away from that. You know, a Super Bowl and maybe another Super Bowl trip with Jaden Daniels, you know, entering his seventh season in the NFL. That's what it would be, right? Seventh season. He's got five left to get to six at Northwest Field in Landover, his seventh season. Kind of for a quarterback entering his prime, you know, at 31 years old, the prime of his career. Imagine it is a Super Bowl contender and a recent Super Bowl champion entering that stadium. It's not going to be cheap. There's no way they can make it cheap with the cost being what it was. And it won't be cheap when you're there. But it'll be worth it, I'm sure. Still a hurdle left to clear. You know, the D.C. Council still has to approve it sometime this summer. That appears to be the chronological timeline. That's next. You know, a summer vote. In the meantime, there will be a lot of pitching, a lot of PowerPoints rolled out, a lot of decks rolled out to talk about the upside, the job creation, the revenue generation, the tax base, etc. This was Phil Mendelson, the chairman of the city council, yesterday. This is, how long is this answer, Max, and him talking about the deal?
This one, the first one he gives is about 40 seconds.
All right, let's play that one.
I am shocked that the deal has gone this far. With some of the terms that I've just learned about, that there was no collaboration or briefing with the council. And I don't want to see a repeat of what we saw in Virginia. The commanders reached out to me late last week. We didn't discuss any of the terms. And I absolutely want to have an open door with the commanders. But trying to jam the council with a July 15th deadline when the mayor hasn't even gotten us to budget. Let me repeat, the mayor will be 7 weeks late in getting us to budget, and that it will be all-consuming for the next 2.5 months.
Yeah, I don't know how to read these things. There are people out there listening to the chairman that understand him and understand how these things work much better than I do. But certainly, I would imagine that it's not in his best interest or anybody's best interest on the council, which will have the final, you know, approval ability on this thing, to just say, I'm all in, whatever they give me, I'm all in, day one. You know, that's not the best leverage to create in what will be a negotiation over a budget, the 26, the fiscal year 26 budget, which will include, you know, at least $500 million for the development of this new stadium. You know, I had, I talked to Eric Flack yesterday after the show on my podcast, and one of the things that, you know, he talked about was, you know, there's been a lot of published reports about the actual expense to taxpayers, et cetera, in the city. And he said, look, the bottom line is if you add it all up, it's about $1.147 billion of public investment. The team has the rest of it, but it's the $500 million for what they call horizontal construction. You know, the vertical construction would be the actual stadium itself. $356 million for parking. That's $181 million up front and $175 million from future tax revenue. $202 million for roads, utilities, a capacity study, and $89 million for a youth sportsplex that they intend on building right on the stadium property. And that's essentially what the number will be for the city and its tax, you know, paying base. And that's what they're going to have to get the council to approve. There are currently only 12 members on the council. There are typically 13, but the Ward 8 council spot is vacant as we speak. So they need 7 out of 12, not 7 out of 13, to vote yes. Now, I think that it will pass. I don't think that yesterday was, you know, a Ted Leonsis, governor of Virginia, and all of the people, remember the tears that were being shed during that press conference, the emotions. I mean, it felt very final. It felt very much like it was a done deal. Why would they do that if it wasn't a done deal? But Virginia has been much more difficult to get things like stadiums built over the years. And Ted and others probably just very much misread not only public reaction, but the Virginia side of it and whether or not they were in position to actually do what the governor was suggesting they would get done. This feels different to me. It's a city council. It's a city. It's not a massive state. Remember, that massive state of Virginia, it's not Wizards Country or Caps Country throughout it. You know, there are a lot of different areas of that state. There's Roanoke, there's Richmond, there's, you know, there's parts of that state that probably did not want to help build a big arena for a billionaire owner. I think this is different. You're not leaving the city. You're coming back to the city. I do feel like it will get passed. I don't know anything other than yesterday seemed like a day in which they wouldn't have taken that step without a firm understanding that this was a sellable deal to the city council. But this is on Mayor Bowser, and I'm sure the team as well, to get it done. It'll be interesting. But yes, you know, what Roger Goodell said also, you know, the generation that missed out, they did miss out on a stadium, I get that, but what they really missed out on was having a football team mean something to the DMV like it used to. That's the bottom line, is the emotional attachment that teams create when they are winners, when they are run well, when they have good people running them, when there are memories that are shared. That sort of emotional attachment, that visceral attachment to a team ends up being a shared experience and a great thing for a city. And yeah, a generation, for the most part, missed out on that. Thank you, Dan. Somebody sent me a note saying, if Dan wants to ever save his legacy or be able to return to D.C., he should just throw in $500 million to the deal and just say, you know what? I didn't do a good job. I'm going to help out. Here's $500 million for the city to throw towards the stadium. Yeah, I wouldn't hold my breath. It is pretty cool, though, that if this deal gets done, and I would put it at, you know, certainly 90% plus, we're less than 10 years away from hosting a Super Bowl. Our city, this area, hosting the biggest event you can host in this country. The biggest sports, the biggest pop culture event that you can host is a Super Bowl, and we are now less than 10 years away from hosting that. It'll be quite the week in 2033, or whenever it is. Maybe it's the 2032 season and a February President's Day weekend Super Bowl, by the way, after an 18-game schedule, and maybe even an expanded playoff after that. But we're less than 10 years away from a Super Bowl. No doubt about that. All right. When we come back, I got a what do you got? I am going to talk about something that I haven't talked about in a few days because of the draft, maybe almost a week because of the draft and because of the big stadium announcement yesterday. But I was up late night again last night, and I wasn't watching hockey. More on that next.
Shangoon is going to inbound. Here comes Van Vliet. On the move, trying to tie. The Golden State Warriors have held on to take a 3-1 lead in the series.
Kevin Harlan, last night, San Francisco was the site of Game 4 between Golden State and Houston. And this game was insane. As three or four games over the last several days have just been unbelievable watch NBA playoff games. Yeah, I'm making my pitch again. Some of you have actually reached out and said, appreciate the suggestion. Watched, you know, Knicks Pistons, great game, watch this. Some of you continue to just mock me for games like last night early when the Cavaliers beat the Heat by 55 points. Yes, the first game of the night featured a 138-83 Cleveland win in Miami to complete an easy sweep in which they won by 21 points, by 9 points, by 37 points, and by 55 points. That was kind of a one-sided series. Late night last night, though, I mean, to watch Steph Curry and Draymond Green and Jimmy Butler on the same team against a young, talented team. Although Van Vliet is the older veteran, and he was on fire last night, even though he missed the three at the buzzer that would have tied it and forced overtime. But this was old-school 80s-style basketball, minus the three-point attempts, okay? Because Golden State did attempt 46 threes. But there were multiple skirmishes in the first half. There have been skirmishes and near fights in almost every game of this series between Houston and Golden State. You had a Houston team in which Sengun, their big dude, basically just backs people down, plays mid-range, plays at the rim. Dylan Brooks is tough. Van Vliet was on fire. Their star, Jalen Green, who averaged over 20 points a game, has been non-existent in this series. Basically, in three of the four games, he's been under 10 points. Steven Adams is a veteran, obviously. I don't even know how old Steven Adams is right now. He's got to be 33, 34, something like that. He's in there knocking people around. Draymond Green's getting flagrant, you know, calls against him, getting a tech, almost got thrown out. But at the end of this thing, man, it was playoff Jimmy at his best. Jimmy Butler is one of the more interesting professional athletes, players in recent memory. He is going to be a Hall of Fame player. There is no doubt that Jimmy Butler has put together a Hall of Fame career. But he's just okay during the regular season. He essentially paces himself during a regular season and then turns into an absolute monster in the postseason. This guy was a phenomenal addition to this team. His basketball IQ, when you combine it with Draymond Green, you can think whatever you want about Draymond Green. He is an absolute maestro when it comes to understanding how to play the game. He's a hothead. He can't control his emotions. All of that, I understand. But he is super smart, super high IQ, and makes everybody around him better. And so does Jimmy Butler. Jimmy Butler, in playoff seasons in Miami, whether they were an 8 seed or a play-in team, or it didn't matter, overachieved every single postseason. Averaged 26.9 points per game in the postseason last year. 27.4 the year before. Now, in 21, he was hurt. In the bubble, averaged 22.2. This guy right now is averaging 18.3 points per game. The game they lost was the game in which he got injured in. They did win a game without him. They won game 3. But last night, he was injured with a pelvic contusion, a pelvic injury. He was not moving at 100%. He had 4 points in the first half, and then with the game on the line, 23 in the second half, 14 of those coming in the fourth quarter. 7 of 12 from the floor, consistently got to the free throw line, and did not miss. Made every right basketball play in 40 minutes, despite handling the ball as much as he did, not one turnover. 6 assists, 5 rebounds, and the biggest rebound of the game, which was off the Houston miss that would have given them the lead with about 5 seconds to go in the game. He's a pleasure to watch this time of year. In real basketball games that are played completely differently than they are during the regular season. The hoops from over the weekend, we didn't have a chance to talk about it yesterday. So much drama, so much controversy. The Knicks-Pistons game ended on a terrible missed call. Tim Hardaway Jr. had a 3-point shot at the buzzer, or with just under a second to go, down 1. He got clearly fouled by Josh Hart, hip-checked. The referee standing right there, no call. And then they admit afterwards with that stupid 2-minute report that they got it wrong, that they missed it. Great. What can you do? Nothing. Instead of 2-2 in the series, they're down 3-1 heading back to the Garden. Then you had this Lakers-Timberwolves game on Sunday, which was insane. J.J. Redick is the head coach of the Lakers, for those of you who don't know, in his first year of being a head coach. He did not sub in the second half. Luka Doncic, LeBron James, Rui Hachimura, Austin Reeves, and Dorian Finney-Smith played the entire second half. Not one sub. Luka was sick on Friday night. He played 46 minutes. LeBron James is 40 years old. He played 46 minutes. And they appeared to run out of gas at the end of that game. I'll say it again about Luka. And now, because of the team he's on, the Lakers, it's a hard watch for anybody that's been involved in basketball going back a long way. It is ISO, stand around, watch one person work basketball at its, you know, absolute worst. It's painful to watch. I don't think you'll ever, with Luka Doncic, win a title. He got to the championship series last year. Got it. Unbelievable scorer, unbelievable playmaker. Will go down as one of the all-time great shot makers and playmakers. But he gets it by pure ISO ball. 14 possessions in the game Sunday. No one but him touched the basketball. LeBron was great in the game, but had a foul at the end and had a turnover at the end that hurt him. Minnesota's Anthony Edwards is, you know, right now you could argue one of the top 2 or 3 players in the game. He went for 43 points to take a 3-1 series lead. And then Saturday, boy, the Nuggets-Clippers game was amazing. The Jokic performance, 36 points, 21 rebounds, 8 assists. He was incredible in the fourth quarter, as was Kawhi Leonard, who just shut everybody down defensively, ended up scoring 24 in the game. And yet, Jokic, with the game tied at the end, threw up an air ball that Aaron Gordon caught and dunked as the buzzer sounded. It may be the closest buzzer beater in the history of the game. It's still sort of undetermined by replay as to whether or not the horn went off, the backboard lit up, before the ball had exited his fingertips. He dunked it at the buzzer. It doesn't matter if the ball's already halfway through the hoop. It matters if his hands are touching it. If any part of a fingertip, fingernail, is on the ball when the horn goes off, it's no good. It was so close. NBA playoffs have been great, and tonight you get four games. Not all of them are great, okay? Bucks are about to go out to the Pacers in five games. The Celtics are about to finish off the Magic in five games. But Pistons-Knicks, game five, even with the Knicks leading 3-1, is a good game. And then late night, and you're going to have to stay up late, and I will be, for Clippers-Nuggets, game five, back in Denver in a 2-2 series. The Clippers, as the road team, are favored tonight. That reeks. I think the Clippers win game five. Would not shock me to see Kawhi go for 40-plus. He went for 39 in game two when they needed to get the split on the road. His road playoff performances are more legendary over the course of his career than his home playoff performances. The NBA playoffs have been phenomenal. I love announcements like yesterday. I love the NFL draft. The games this time of year in hockey and in the NBA are the most meaningful of the season, and they're awesome to watch. All right, when we come back, some NFL draft talk. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com.
All right, the San Francisco 49ers have locked up George Kittle with a four-year, $76 million extension. That includes $40 million guaranteed. He becomes the highest-paid tight end in the National Football League. Yesterday, not a fun day to be a Nats fan as they got smoked by the New York Mets 19-5. Brandon Nimmo went 4-for-6 with two home runs, including a grand slam totaling 9 RBI. And Trevor Williams pitched 5.1 innings, earned 5 Ks, and gave up 5 earned runs in the start. Speaking of smoked, the Cleveland Cavaliers completed their sweep of the Miami Heat, 138-83, a 55-point loss for Miami. That marks the fourth largest playoff loss in NBA history. On the other side, the Golden State Warriors take a 3-1 lead over the Houston Rockets, 109-106. Jimmy Butler leads the Warriors in scoring with 27 points, including the final free throws to close out the contest. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980, and hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1 and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that's what's trending.
Ben Raby will join us at 11. We'll talk some hockey with Ben. You'll hear Cooley next hour. And then we may get Ben Standing back on the show because he was on with us for a whopping 2.5 minutes yesterday at the very end of the show after the press conference. I got this from Dolph. Dolph wrote, Kevin. Oh, first of all, the subject, because this was an email, Commanders draft, tragically bad media. Kevin, the Commanders had a solid draft, but the talk shows and pundits were simply awful. Everyone said they had to take an edge in a draft deep with edge rushers. Wrong. Nobody I listened to, you, John Kime, Ben Standing, Nikki, got any of the names right. Weeks, if not months of work and lots of, they really like this guy and that guy. It was all wrong. I know the excuse. This was an unpredictable draft, but the magnitude of the miss by the media and pundits was epic. Perhaps some humility is in order, and maybe an apology. Thank you, Dolph. That was outstanding. Yeah, we were talking edge, no doubt. We were talking edge pass rusher a lot. They needed one, and this draft was very deep in edge and defensive ends. So thinking that they would take an edge and a defensive end and mentioning many of the names that we mentioned along the way, and I don't know the names that Kime, although John did come on with me. Nikki came on with me, too. All those people came on. We talked a lot of names, and none of those people ended up in a Washington draft class. That is true. But, I mean, are you kidding me? Seriously. I mean, is this your first draft? Like, is this the first draft you've actually watched and consumed? Come on, man. Nobody gets this thing right. Especially, by the way, if you're picking at 29. You know, picking and mocking out the top five typically isn't that hard. So last year, you know, we all had Jaden. We kind of knew it was going to be Jaden. But I wasn't sitting there, you know, holding up my arms in a V saying, I got it right. I got Jalen right. I've been predicting. Look, I love the player, and I was thrilled they did it, and I would have criticized them had they not picked him. But everybody knew when we got to draft day they were going to pick him. This is the draft that is. This is tops on the list of things we talk about during the course of the 12-month sports calendar that we don't know anything about. We don't know anything. That's why these grades that come afterwards and, you know, let Adam cook and Adam's playing chess, everybody else is playing checkers. How do you know? You don't know anything. This is the number one. We don't know anything. You know how I know that? Because the people that get paid millions of dollars a year to do this for teams, they don't get it right most of the time. Now, I know what you're referring to, Dolph. You're referring to more of the predictions of what Washington would do. Because we don't know. There were a lot of players that I discussed heading into the draft. And really, my conversations were more about the players that I liked. Yes, I thought some of those players would not be good fits for Washington, and others might be. But, you know, you can't really predict at 29, and by the way, five picks, you know, late in the round, in each of these rounds. You don't know what options are going to exist when they're on the clock. Look, I love the conversation about the draft. I love the draft. I've always loved the draft. But I'm not, you know, sitting here telling you that I've got their whole draft pegged out perfectly, or that everybody that I've looked at is going to end up being great. This is a 35 to 40% business when it's done well by the people who do it well, and you don't know for 3 years. Somebody sent me an email, too, saying, you throw that figure out a lot. How do you know? Well, PFF did a thing a while back, and I couldn't find that one, but I found an updated study in which essentially they looked at they looked at down the road snap counts. They, rather than trying to define what a, you know, meaningful contributor was, they looked at snap counts and snap counts by positions, because, you know, snap counts are different position by position. And, you know, there are certain positions that actually have a long-term better chance of being contributors. Interior linemen, both sides of the ball, tend to have better chances, whereas a lot of skill position players don't. And certainly first-rounders have a better chance than the rest of your draft. Like right now, the average since the fifth-year option went into place, which was 2011, and really, we only have the data of 2011 through 2021, because you have to wait a few years before you know whether or not teams picking up the options by, I think, May 1st is the deadline. I think this week is the deadline for fifth-year options. But it's the fifth-year option on players who were drafted in 2022. So for 2011 through 2021, I saw essentially 59.8% of first-rounders were either extended or the fifth-year options were picked up. Now, the fifth-year options being picked up did not necessarily mean that the player was a good player or had contributed a lot. It was, at times, sometimes like, we got to give it one more shot here. We got to pick up the fifth-year option and just give it another shot. But still, that means on first-rounders, you know, you're talking about essentially 40.2% don't work out. That's first round. So, yes, for a seven-round draft, if 3 years down the road, by position, that player that you picked is contributing a certain number of snaps, which PFF defined as, you know, that defines a successful pick, and you're hitting at basically anywhere higher than like 37%, you've had a successful draft. So, yeah, it's Dolph. I love the email because it made me laugh out loud. But at the same time, I'm not about to give you an apology, because in the process, I think there's been humility. The humility is, hey, we don't know what we're talking about. I don't know what I'm talking about, but we're going to have the conversation anyway, because this is such a massive event, the draft. And the draft does end up being a big part of a foundation of a team moving forward, whether it's one draft, typically not, or a combination of like three drafts where, you know, if you get a chance to pick, let's just say 24 players over a three-year period, you know, can you hit on somewhere around 10 of those 24? If you do, in 3 years, you've got 10 significant contributing members. It's the foundation for something. But it's too hard, man. Nobody gets this right. You know, I'm not sitting here auditing anybody else either, because I know, I all due respect to people that, you know, are putting out mock drafts and people who are talking about the draft in the same way I do. I know that they're not going to get most things right. Now, with respect to your specific criticism about an edge, a defensive end, yeah, I'm surprised they didn't take one. I am. You have to take that and say, well, what is it that they see about their current roster that allowed them to be comfortable not taking a defensive end edge in a draft that most thought was loaded with them? It's very possible that every time they were on the clock, there was a player that was the best player available, and that player was just much better than the defensive edge player, defensive end edge player that they liked, and then that player ended up getting picked. You know, I actually think that's the way they do draft. I think we've seen that now for 2 years. They really are a best player available on their board team. And you could make the case going into this draft that other than quarterback and just a guy that you were going to play at left tackle, because they weren't going to draft a guy that was going to play at left tackle because of what they traded to get Tunsil, that everything else was in play. And we did talk about that. Everything else was in play. You know, if the best player available on their board is an offensive lineman at 29, they're going to take that player. And guess what? They did. If the best player available on their board at 61 in the second round is a corner, and that player is better than the defensive end edge that's on the board, they're going to take the corner. I can't tell you how close they were to drafting a defensive end or an edge. I do think that had Josh Connerly had been drafted before 29 in the first round, I think that there was a possibility in Azaraku from Boston College would have been the pick, or they would have traded back and potentially gotten him in the second round and picked up an additional pick. Because I do believe Adam Peters at his word that there were offers to move back. But Connerly Jr. was clearly the best player on their board, and they picked him. Azaraku, for those of you that didn't follow, went in the second round, 12th pick of the second round, to the Cowboys, who many people are saying the Cowboys had a great draft. Okay, maybe. I don't know. If you want to evaluate a draft and you want to do it solely based on a consensus of the projections of where the player was supposed to be picked, I'm fine with that, but even that's dangerous, especially in a draft like this year's draft where you had a slug of players, you know, call it 40 to 60 players that basically were thought to be anywhere from mid-first to mid-third. You know, so that's really hard. Like, I think Washington selecting Trey Amos in the second round and at the end of the second round looks like great value based on where he was projected to go. So if you want to say they got tremendous value with Amos in the second round, they got tremendous value with Kane Medrano from UCLA in the sixth round, if you want to evaluate the draft that way, but evaluating the draft based on the player's ability at the next level, the fit, the opportunity, the player, the scheme, etc. I mean, go for it. I mean, the Cowboys drafted Tyler Booker, 12 overall. That was a player that a lot of teams liked. I think Washington liked Tyler Booker a lot. But then again, Dolph, if Tyler Booker had been on the board and they had selected Connerly Jr., would have looked terrible. But there were a few things that I'm sure others, you know, kind of learned a little bit. This group is much more tight-lipped than previous groups. There were, you know, previous groups, not just the Allen group necessarily, but even the Rivera group, that there was more information. This group is tight-lipped. I love that about them because I think it's smart. But the Cowboys drafted, you know, Booker, Ezeraku, and Revelle Jr. In the first three rounds, and all three of those guys had, you know, had been mocked in the first round. They got Jaden Blue, the running back from Texas, in the fifth round. He had been mocked as high as the second round. So, you know, if you want to base it off that, that's fine. But it's a hard thing, man, the draft. It's fun, but I think the constant reminder to myself and to those of you listening that we don't know anything about anything, but it's not going to stop us from having these conversations. It's not going to stop me from doing draft prep work and telling you who I like based on watching them as college football players or watching their, you know, tape, not as an expert, and reading about the players and their overall, you know, intangibles or lack thereof, etc. And let me just mention again, my favorite pick in Washington's draft, and I acknowledge going in that there's just as much chance he'll get cut as he will end up becoming a significant player for this franchise. But I loved watching Kane Medrano, the linebacker from UCLA, over the weekend. He's not a player that I spent any time looking at before the draft. I should have, because he was a top 30 visit, but he was the most athletic linebacker in terms of 40 time, ran 4.46. He vertical jumped 38 inches, and there is just a Micah Hyde, Andrew Van Ginkle kind of anticipation ability and feel for the game that he has in watching him that I was blown away by watching him. In fact, if I didn't say this yesterday, I know I said it on my podcast, but at 6'3", 222, he's a bit undersized to play linebacker. He actually looks like more of a safety. I don't know where they'll play him, but he's the guy that I'm excited to see when we get to training camp and beyond, because he's just got that playmaking, that instinctive, you know, feel for where the ball's going to be and timing it up right. Yeah, I like him. And watching all these players, there was something to like about a lot of them, for sure. But again, scheme, fit, opportunity, you know, then all of the intangible stuff, all that stuff matters. The one thing I feel good about with this group is I feel like, you know, they are picking players that are A, athletic. They've added some team speed in this draft, which I thought they needed to do. And they're not adding knuckleheads. They have steered clear of knuckleheads. At this point, they have. That reminds me, we will do a Shedeur Sanders discussion a little bit later on in the show. We'll talk some Caps next with Ben Raby. It's the Kevin Sheehan Show on the Team 980, theteam980.com. We're also free and live on the Odyssey app. And if you download that app, you can simply open up the Team 980 YouTube page, although you don't need the app to do that. Go to the Team 980 YouTube page. And we're streaming live there every day from 10 to 1. Craig does the same thing from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and subscribe to the stream. That helps us out a lot if you can do that. Caps Talk next.